Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for coming out tonight. This is so great. I see some regular faces. We've been doing this long enough that we have regulars. That's so good. Hello and welcome to our very first Get Lit with All of It book club event of 2020. We are here live in the green space. Oh, we're going to dig into the book we've been reading together all this month, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed by Lori Gottlieb. We're also going to talk with Dr. Gerald Salt about how to find a good therapist, because I don't know about you, but I thought I might need one after reading the book. And we will hear music from Jill Sobule. That's all coming your way. And now for the main event, our Get Lit with All of It book club pick for this month, Lori Gottlieb's Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Here's the story. When we meet Los Angeles-based therapist Lori Gottlieb, she has her hands full. She has a patient who is terminally ill, a patient who calls people idiots when they don't get things exactly his way. And then there's the fact that Lori realizes she needs therapy herself. What sends this therapist into therapy, the presenting problem, as Lori calls it, is a really bad breakup. Laura's fiancé reveals to her, sort of kind of out of the blue, that he just doesn't think he can help raise another kid. Specifically, he doesn't want to talk to Lori's son about Legos. So Lori heads to get help coping and is ready for her therapist, named Wendell, to tell her what a jerk her ex is. Her therapist, fortunately, has other ideas. Lori writes about her experiences with therapy from both sides of the chair in her New York Times bestselling memoir that the New York Times called irresistibly candid and addicting. Please welcome Lori Gottlieb.
Hello.
Oh, Lori, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We're very excited. As you can see, we have a full house with some standing room only. So we really know that people want to hear from you tonight. But it's interesting. As I was reading the book, I thought, in theory, we should be sitting here discussing a book about happiness. Because if you read the book, you know that Lori was supposed to write a book about happiness, and you just couldn't get to it. Why couldn't you get to that?
You know, when I was writing that book, I was starting out as a therapist, and I felt like what I was seeing in the therapy room was so much more about the human condition than a book about happiness. And in fact, I feel like happiness as a byproduct of living our lives in a fulfilling way is what we all want. But happiness as the end goal is kind of a recipe for disaster. And in fact, the writing of the happiness book got me depressed. I called it the miserable depression-inducing happiness book because I really wanted to bring people into the therapy room and show them what I had the privilege of seeing every day.
So there are five people that you follow in your book, including yourself. You have, as I mentioned, a young woman who is dying, a sort of gruff, and I'm going to say a little bit rude, TV producer, a senior citizen who's just kind of a misanthrope, and a young woman with sort of impulse control. And then there's you. So when you thought about writing this book, how did you know it was going to be this kind of book? It could have just been about your patients. It could have just been about you. Why did you think the combination was going to be powerful?
I thought it was really important because I chose these four patients who seem very different from one another on the surface. But underneath it all, as you get to know them, you see how similar we all are. And I didn't want to be the expert up on high. I say at the very beginning of the book that my greatest credential is that I'm a card-carrying member of the human race. And I was going through something at the time, and I felt like it would almost be disingenuous not to include that entire part of the story. So I'm the fifth patient, and I go to see my therapist as I'm treating my patients, and we're all growing and changing through this process.
In terms of your patients, and I know you can't break patient doctor confidentiality, what did you think? I know you went to them and said, I want to include you in our story. What did they say to you?
I was a writer long before I was a therapist, so I came to this later in life. And everyone who comes to me knows that there's a possibility that as long as I disguise their identities, they might be written about. But this was different because this was a really in-depth look at the treatment as it unfolded. I think people were honored by the way that they were written about, and I think they were surprised that I thought about them as much as I did. You know, I think a lot of us wonder, so your therapist sees you for 50 minutes a week, and then do they forget about you for the rest of the week? And they were really moved by how much I cared and how much they had come into my life and helped me as a person to become a better therapist and to become a better person.
That was surprising to me, how much you thought about your patients, because I did go to therapy. And I remember one time her saying, like, I heard that interview you did. It was great. And it shocked me. I was like, wait, I exist outside of this room? Why do you think patients don't think about their therapists that way?
It's interesting, because I think that in reality, most of the therapy happens outside of the room, and people don't realize this. So there's the 50 minutes in the room, but if you aren't doing something with the therapy outside of the room, you're not really getting therapy. You're not really making use of the therapy. Mm-hmm. I always say that insight is the booby prize of therapy, that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't make changes out in the world, the insight is useless. So somebody might say in therapy, you know, now I understand why I'm having these arguments with my partner. And then I say, well, did you do something different during the argument with your partner? Well, no, but I understand why I did it. Uh-huh. Well, you're not really working in therapy. So I think that it's not really an isolated 50 minutes, but for a lot of people, it's very discombobulating when they run into their therapist outside of the therapy room. It's almost like when you're a kid and you run into your teacher in like Best Buy and she's in cutoff shorts with her husband or something and her kids, and you're like, wait, you don't sleep in the classroom? I think people think that about their therapist too.
My guest is Lori Gottlieb. We're talking about her memoir, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. So you described the language of presenting problem. That's what happened. That's what somebody gets somebody into the therapist's office. People aren't sleeping well, they're obsessing about somebody, they can't get out of the job they want to get out of. When you first went to your therapist, what was your presenting problem?
So my presenting problem was that the person that I was going to marry told me that he decided that he couldn't live with a kid under his roof for the next 10 years. That kid at the time was my 8-year-old. And my version of the story, and I very purposely say my version of the story, just to, no spoilers here, but was that he was a sociopath. No, my version of the story, that was my friend's version of the story, and I didn't disagree. My version of the story was that I was blindsided, that I had no idea that there were no signs of this. And I was sure that when I went to therapy, that my therapist was going to wholeheartedly agree with me, that I had dodged a bullet, that, you know, this was a blessing in disguise, all of those cliches. And that would make me feel better. And that might have made me feel better in the moment, but ultimately it was not what was going to help me. And I always, when I have patients come in, I'm always listening for what I like to say, the music under the lyrics. So the lyrics are, I had this breakup, here's what happened. The music is, what is the underlying struggle or pattern that got you into this situation in the first place?
What have you found from your practice is the biggest obstacle to hearing that music?
I think that we all believe that our version of the story is entirely 100% accurate and the full version. Mm. So, and I talk about the difference in the book between idiot compassion and wise compassion, right? So idiot compassion is what our friends do. They go along with our version of the story. They say, yeah, you're right. You know, he was a jerk, or yeah, your boss should have promoted you, even though we know you don't really deserve the promotion. Or so we go along with it because we think we're being supportive. Wise compassion is what happens in the therapy room. It's we're holding up a mirror to the person to help them to see themselves in a way that maybe they haven't been willing or able to do. And ultimately, that is going to help them to grow and change and navigate their life differently. So it's not just about solving that one thing that you came in for. It's about how can you figure out what got you there so that you don't end up there again.
How do you know when you have a good fit with your therapist?
That's an excellent question, because every study shows that the most important factor in the success of your therapy is your relationship with your therapist. So more than their training or years of experience or the modality they use, all of which are important, you have to have a good relationship with your therapist. I think that people don't trust themselves to to leave if they don't have that good fit. And people think that you're going to hurt the therapist's feelings. They don't realize that you're there for you. So what a lot of people do is they just keep going in therapy and they're not making any progress and they're afraid to leave, or they just leave one day and never come back and they ghost the therapist. And a really good thing for them to do is to say, hey, you know, I'm not sure that this is working, and to talk about it with the therapist, because we don't want to keep you there if we're not helping you. And so maybe we're not aware that this is how you're feeling, and we want to talk about what's getting in the way, and maybe it truly isn't a good match, in which case we don't want to keep you there.
What made Wendell a good fit for you?
Wendell was very different from me, and that ultimately was exactly what I needed. He was much farther along in his career, so he was much more experienced than I was. He was very quirky, and he brought his whole personality into the room in a way that I didn't know at that time in my career that you could. So he does a lot of very unconventional things in the room. He doesn't cross any weird boundaries. There's nothing creepy going on. You know, he's not self-disclosing. Mm-hmm. He's not talking about himself, but he's very effective in reaching me on a very human level, which I think is different from what we see in like movies and television. And I think also different from what we're taught in grad school in terms of how we're supposed to be in the room. He was just entirely authentic.
I'm curious about it. We learn in the book that you had a health condition, but you don't tell him right away.
Yes.
You withhold that information. As a therapist, what difficulty does that present for you? I mean, aside from the obvious of you not having all the information, when a patient is not honest with you.
Most people are not entirely honest when they first come in, not because they're lying, but because of what they choose to tell you and what they choose not to tell you. And I think it's a natural instinct to want your therapist to like you and to want to come off well in front of this other person. And so maybe we aren't sharing everything at the beginning. And sometimes it's not even conscious. Sometimes you're just, you tell yourself, that's not really important, even though it's the most important thing and the thing you really need to be talking about. So I think it takes a little time for people to take off their mask, and that's part of the work of me as a therapist is to figure out what are they not telling me. So I'm listening for what they're saying, and I'm also listening for what they're not saying.
Is there anything that's sort of a telltale sign that you know when you're talking to somebody, you're like, okay. There's more here.
Yeah. And you can see that unfold in the book too with a lot of people. But I might not know what the thing is, but I might, guess that there is something else there. Sometimes when people are just trying to distract you, you know, they're sort of chatting, they're trying to entertain you. They're kind of like, look over here. And you have no idea what they're talking about. What is the thread of the story? And I'm always wondering when someone's talking, why are they telling me this? What is the purpose of this story that they're telling me right now? Is it a distraction from what we're supposed to be talking about or what we need to be talking about? Or is there something about this story that there's something deeper to it that they're feeling a lot of shame around and they're staying on the surface of it because they don't want to go down into the shame?
So if someone's listening to this and they have a therapy session tomorrow and they want to be an excellent patient, if they really want to move it forward, what's something they could do?
To be an excellent patient, you just have to show the truth of who you are. And so many people are afraid to do that because they're afraid that if they show the truth of who they are, that people are going to judge them or feel a certain way about them. And the truth is that if you show the truth of who you are, people will be drawn toward you because that's how humans connect. And it's not just true in the therapy room. It's true in life. But so often we feel like we have to project a certain image, and it's very hard for us to let go of that.
I'm going to flip it around. You have a patient you write about who you have patience with this patient. I don't want to say he's awful, but he's terribly rude in the beginning. I mean, for people who haven't read the book or haven't gotten that deep into it, he likens you to a hooker because he pays you in cash and he throws it down. And he's very, he is very entitled with his space. He's going to eat his food in the session. Not particularly this patient, but what do you do as a therapist when you have someone you just don't like?
So I think there's a difference between someone that you would choose as a friend and someone that you can feel a lot of compassion for. And I think in his case, it was so obvious to me that he had some very deep pain that he was so wanting to avoid. And so he couldn't let anybody get close to him. And so he would be kind of a jerk to people so that they couldn't get close to him. Those were just his defenses. And I needed to figure out a way to get underneath those defenses. And what's interesting about him is that I think that for people who have read the book, he becomes someone that most people feel very close to by the end of the book. They feel so much compassion for him and they're rooting for him. And dare I say, they like him.
What about someone who's not him? Is it appropriate to ask someone to leave a practice because
sure.
you're just not connecting or just you don't feel like you can get past?
Sure. So
the
when
end,
I was
the
yeah.
disconnect?
So when I was training, a supervisor said to me, "There's something likable in everyone. It's your job to find it." And I thought, "Yeah, well, I don't know about everyone." but it's true. I think that I have found something likable in every single person that I have seen. Now, there was a case in the book that I write about of a woman who would, you know, she was in her 20s and she was having some relational difficulties. And she would come in every week and tell me in all different kinds of ways that I was incompetent and not helping her. And she wouldn't leave. So that was really challenging. Did I like her? I felt like I don't know if I would have liked her because I could never see who she was. So I was only seeing the persona that she was presenting to me, but I'll bet that if she had let me get to know her, I would have liked her very much. I just couldn't get to that place with her.
My guest is Lori Gottlieb. The name of the book is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. It is our this month's Get Lit with All of It book club pick. We'll have more with Lori live from the Green Space. This is All of It on WNYC. We're live from the Green Space with our Get Lit with All of It book club. And the book we've all been reading this month is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone from Lori Gottlieb. The subtitle is A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Lori, we learned so much about you and your life. You had such an interesting career path. You worked as a journalist. You worked in TV. And you made what I think a lot of people think is a really big leap. I mean, it's interesting that you went to your therapist for a broken heart to a degree, but you've done things that people can't imagine doing, like just switching careers. What was at the core of you realizing that you wanted to make that big a leap into being a therapist?
When I look back on all the different parts of my career, whether that was working in film and TV or going to medical school or being a journalist and being a therapist, I've always been interested in story and the human condition. And I feel like all of those things were simply looking at it from a different perspective. And I use all of that background every day as a therapist. I feel like a lot of what I do as a therapist is I'm an editor in the room and people bring me their stories. And usually most of us are unreliable narrators. And I'm helping people to do a rewrite on their stories. And part of it is that we're unreliable about other people. You know, people come in and they say, "I want to change." But what they really mean is, "I want someone else or something else to change." And so we have to rewrite the story and help them to see how can they be the protagonist in their story. And sometimes the story that they tell themselves about themselves needs a rewrite. Like, people can be so unkind to themselves. And so I had a patient leave and write down everything that she was saying to herself for 3 days and then come back and tell me about it. And she came back in and she said, "I can't read this. I am such a bully to myself." Wow. And she started to read it and you know, it was these kinds of things that we all do, like, "I'm such an idiot, I made a mistake," or, "God, I look terrible today," or, you know, "Oh, that was so awkward." And if your friend experienced the same thing, you would never think that about your friend. It's not only that you wouldn't say it, you actually wouldn't believe it. But we can be so critical of ourselves and so unkind. And so those stories need a rewrite too.
Let's talk about Julie in the book. What a challenging experience that was for you professionally. Julie asks Lori to remain her therapist as she's dying. What did you think when she asked that?
So I wish that I could say that the therapy session went like this. She said, "Will you stay with me until I die?" which is what she did say. And that I said, "Of course I will." And we hugged. Okay, that is not what happened. What actually happened was I hesitated, and she saw me hesitate. And I hesitated, I thought at the time, because I thought, you know, I don't have a lot of experience dealing with a young person, a newlywed in her 30s, who's dying of cancer. And I want, she's only going to get one chance at this, and I don't want to mess it up for her. But I think that later on, I realized that the real reason that I hesitated was because it's hard for all of us to look at death and to look death in the eye in the way that it would be required of me. And yet it was one of the most meaningful, rich experiences, I think, for both of us as she went through that. I think we learned a lot from each other, not so much about death, although partly about death, but mostly about life.
What was different in your approach of working with her than some of your other patients?
I think that I was much more aware of time with her. Mm-hmm. Not only of her time, but of time that we all have to think about, being very intentional about the fact that life has 100% mortality rate. And it's not just for other people, that's for all of us. And I think that it helped me to live more intentionally. And I think that Julie made choices in her life knowing that her time was extremely limited. And so my approach was, we don't have any time to waste. We got to really get to it, and we got to get to it quickly.
Another one of your patients we meet, Charlotte, claims that she's addicted to therapy, and she's addicted to seeing you. Is there such a thing?
She believed there was. You know, I think that, you know, and she kept leaving because she felt like I was her addiction, and she was trying to sort of break the addiction. Ultimately, I think she came to realize that she was afraid of confronting the fact that she kept hooking up with all the wrong guys, including eventually a guy from the waiting room. I don't mean they hooked up in the waiting room, by the way. Our office is not that exciting. But you know, she kept picking guys who were completely inappropriate for her. And once she was able to stop with the distraction of, I'm addicted to you, I'm addicted to therapy, she was able to sit with, oh, maybe the common denominator in all of these encounters that I'm having is me, and maybe I'm choosing people who are going to let me down and disappoint me.
Should we be Googling our therapist, Lori?
So the answer is no. And yet, I did Google my therapist, and what I found was that his father had died at a relatively young age. Suddenly, his father had been a marathon runner and seemed to be in perfect health, and I had been talking about my very close relationship with my aging father in my therapy sessions, and once I Googled this and found this, I went back to therapy, and I stopped talking about that because I felt like I would be causing him pain. And what I should have done was say, hey, I Googled you. I found this out per the obituary that I found after 2 hours of Google stalking you. You know, I learned this information. And that's not what I did at first. And he realized that something weird was going on in the room. You can feel, as a therapist, you can feel that something has shifted. And I confessed to him eventually that's what I did. And we had this wonderful conversation about fathers and my father. And I don't think we would have had that deep conversation about my father in the same way had I not told him what I had found. But I think when you start Googling anyone, not just your therapist, you have to ask, what is the purpose of this? What do I want to get out of this? And is this going to serve me? And I think that your answer will be no.
My guest is Lori Gottlieb. The name of the book is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Okay, audience, you get to ask a question of Lori.
Hi, Lori. Loved your
Hi
book.
Hi there. Thank you.
My question for you is, how did you choose what patients to include in your book?
That's a great question. I wanted to choose people who seemed very different on the surface, because I wanted to show how similar we all are. And I thought it was important to show different kinds of people, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, people who are different genders, different ages, different personalities, different histories, different presenting problems. And I thought that these people, especially in the way that they transform themselves without having the ending being wrapped up in a bow, I thought that was really important to show all of their stories and how they're all connected and how they were connected to mine as well.
Hi there. Conventionally, it seems that most therapists don't put much information about themselves into the world. I was just wondering, in light of this book and perhaps other things that you've written, how it's impacted the way you perform your therapy with patients who now know something more personal about you.
Right. So I was a writer before I became a therapist or had any idea that I would become a therapist. So there might have been things that I would have chosen not to write about if I knew later that I would become a therapist. And not because I'm embarrassed about any of them, but just because it's a lot of information to have out there in this age of the internet. But given that, I also felt like this book, maybe three people would read it. I didn't realize that more than three people would read it. And so I really let it rip, right? I was very vulnerable and open and honest. And I think that if I had known how many people would read it, I might have tried to clean myself up a little bit, especially in those early chapters. But I also think that the reason that so many people have read it is because I didn't clean myself up, because I was very real and relatable and authentic. And so when people, if people have read the book, yes, they know that about me. But even my own patients, when I published the book and I went off on book tour and I didn't tell them I was leaving because of a book. I just said, I will be out of the office on these dates and I'll see you on this date. And when I came back, some people came in and they sat on my couch and they said, so I read your book. And we had these really beautiful conversations, not about me, because people really aren't that interested in me. They're there for them, but about them and their reactions to the book, and also about our relationship, because one of the real keys of the book is the relationships between me and my patients and me and my therapist. And they didn't know that they were allowed to talk about that relationship in the room in the same way. And a lot of people, in fact, there's a moment in the book where I ask Wendell, my therapist, I say, do you like me? And so a lot of people I've heard are going to their therapist now and they're saying, I read this book, and in the book she says to her therapist, do you like me? Isn't that interesting? So I think that it's given my patients permission to talk with me about our relationship as well.
You've been on book tour. You've engaged with all kinds of audiences. These are stressful times. What's on people's minds when they come up to you and you're signing books? Because I know sometimes people will lean in and talk to you about something, or they'll catch you in the lobby of an event. What's on people's minds right now?
I think two big themes. One is this question of how can I love and be loved? I think everybody has that question. And I think people are finding it harder to navigate that in today's world, where people are treated more like a shopping expedition and less like another human being that you might get to know. And I think related to that is an epidemic of loneliness. Even for people who are happily in relationship, I think that we aren't connecting with people in a way that feels nourishing and fulfilling. And so many times we'll be sitting with someone and our phones are sitting on the table and we're not giving somebody our full attention. So I think that a lot of people are feeling like not only are they not being heard, but they don't know how to listen.
The name of the book is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Reveal. Lori Gottlieb, thank you so much for giving us so much time tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me here.
This is all of it.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.